Great. First of all, welcome. Thank you to Dr. Straw, because he was in fact prescient. He was talking about doing the 2012 annual conference on crime last spring. The timing of this conference was also due to Dr. Will Straw, and his team at the Institute has done a fantastic job. So I'd like to thank them on my behalf and on behalf of everyone here for the conference. I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing our panelists. We have a stellar group of panelists. Their bio is included in your conference package, so I would urge you to actually read it. This particular subject, who polices the police, qui maintient l'ordre chez la police, is very timely given what's happening in the days that have just passed, today and days to come. So I'm going to begin. Each panelist has 10 minutes, and I'm a strict taskmaster. I'm going to begin with Maître Nathalie Desrosiers, General Counsel for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Welcome, Nathalie, and the floor is yours.
Merci.
Merci. Alors, merci. Merci beaucoup de l'invitation. Mes remarques sont en français et en anglais. J'aborde donc le thème de « Who polices the police » ou encore « Une imputabilité à la mesure de nos attentes démocratiques ». Les points que je vais faire ici sont les suivants. « Accountability is not an option. It's a requirement in a democracy. There's no powers that can be exercised without an accountable framework. » C'est cette obligation, pas ce désir, cette option, mais vraiment une obligation d'imputabilité que je veux développer ici. My theme will be that police forces generally in Canada need to embrace accountability, not resist it. It's not a nuisance. It's indeed incumbent upon them to see this as an enrichment and a betterment of the policing in our country. So I will talk a little bit about some of the issues and the problems that we see in maybe not a complete embrace as of now. So to have to really develop more fully this idea of the obligation of democratic and accountability for policing, I will advance that it needs to be threefold. The accountability regime needs to be credible. It needs to be responsive, it needs to be effective. And in my view, there is failings on the three scores. Mais je veux bien être comprise. L'Association canadienne des libertés civiles reconnaît et soutient le droit des policiers comme individus à avoir des droits procéduraux. Due process for police officers is welcome and is accepted as part of our regime and as part of what we're looking after. What I'm going to be talking about here is how the system more generally does not respond to the desire and the need for proper accountability. It's not credible enough. Accountability from the civilian perspective is inevitable. Civilian oversight is inevitable in the context of policing oversight. It's not a question of whether, when, how much, how come. It must be seen as being essential to the credibility of the system. It is necessary not only because it will, you know, reduce the gap that now exists between the expectations of the public and the way in which the framework works. And this gap, ce que je définis comme le déficit de crédibilité, ne fait que s'élargir. Aujourd'hui, ce que je vais tenter de suggérer, c'est qu'il y a une certaine urgence à ce qu'il y ait des démarches et des façons de faire qui soient faites tout de suite, maintenant, non seulement de façon symbolique, mais avec un engagement réel pour que les choses changent. Nous sommes à un point tournant où on peut voir soit un désengagement de la population par rapport à sa police. Et je pense que c'est nécessaire de mettre ces choses dans un contexte. Il faut que ça se passe, et il faut que ça se passe rapidement. Les deux objections traditionnelles au civilian oversight are that civilians are unable, or lack competence to do a good job of doing oversight. And the second one is that there's less acceptability of their findings among the force if it comes from civilian. Both of these objections, I think, have been proven not to be completely realistic. But my point here is that they are, even if there is an iota of credibility to either of these objections, they pale in comparison to the advantage of civilian oversight and civilian engagement with the police, not from the force's point of view as well. There's a great discipline in explaining to an outsider why you're doing something. And this discipline will help police make their case to the general public more credible, more reasonable, and more sensitive to their needs. So the discipline that people have in teaching others what they're all about is what I'm suggesting here. When you teach, in teaching others, you learn a lot about yourself. And at times, it could be that the outsider would say, mais pourquoi? Pourquoi vous faites ça comme ça? Why this? And this, indeed, is a value, is an enrichment to the process. So my point is, it's not to be resisted. It should be welcome. There may be all sorts of models. I'm not going to go into it in 10 minutes. Certainly, the CCLA has a long history of saying it needs to have an audit component. Complaints are not enough. It needs to have civilian truly fully involved in the process, and it has to have a capacity to absorb and cooperate with this system. So it needs to be credible. Secondly, it needs to be responsive. And it needs to be responsive to the range of needs. And the range of needs are this. It needs to be responsive on a human scale. There is a great power dynamics between police officers and the people that who may be abused or may want to complain about police behavior. There is a power, we see it every day at CCLA. We have people that call that do not want, cannot make a complaint. And when the process is so bureaucratic, long, and there's nothing in it for the complainant, it makes the system unresponsive. What we have seen, I mean, we've been doing this work for a while, what we have seen often is the police showing up at the door with in charge of the investigation into the complaints and saying, well, finally, you know, we cannot identify the police officers that you're complaining about, and therefore would you, can you withdraw your complaint and here's the form. This is so completely unresponsive to the need of someone who has made a complaint. It's a democratic act to complain when we see an injustice. It's not a nuisance. It is an act that we should encourage. That's the way we learn and get better. So, you know, there are great ways in which, in the petite choses, in the management of the complaints, lots of improvements must be done. It must be responsive, I think, on a systemic nature in the new forms of policing. And in our view, I think what we when there is multi-forces policing, there needs to be a regime of accountability that's multi-force. You cannot have the regime of accountability to be provincially based, to have to identify each police officer to know where to put a complaint in order to respond. That's what happened at the G20. There were the police forces from all across Canada, and to put we had to do complaints all across Canada to try to get a sense of where this was going. Anyway, it has to be effective. I think the bureaucratic, the length that it takes, I think is a disservice both to the forces and to the general public. There's a way in which the lack of cooperation is indeed undermining the credibility of the system itself. Let me just say, I mean, in a way, I think there's nothing worse for the public to have the problem of identification. C'est complètement incompréhensible pour le public d'avoir une réponse qui dit « Nous ne sommes pas capables d'identifier le policier ou l'agent de police qui a commis tel ou tel acte. » Pour any employer should know where their employees are. If people are paid, surely they know whether they're on duty or not. So from the citizens' perspective, that's the complaints we get every day. People just don't understand that. And I think there's something to be said about a positive, proactive obligation to come forward with saying, even if we will find this, we will help and try to determine who was in charge. But I think the accountability has to be more than individual. There needs to be an ownership of the accountability from management. I think that would go a long way to responding to what I think is a bit of a crisis. Now, you know, I have all sorts of suggestions that I think, you know, we have said, you know, we need to routinize, to normalize accountability. I mean, I come from the academic sector where every course is evaluated at the end, you know, and many students make unreasonable comments in this evaluation. You know, they don't like the prof, you know. Well, you know, we don't respond immediately by putting people on discipline, but it normalizes the process where it's okay. So I've always asked, how come there's no house, you know, how's my driving? How's my policing? Why is it that there's not client surveys at the end of an interaction? Why is it, I mean, sometimes when it's so difficult to get any information, you wonder whether they will need to have informants within the police force to know what's going on. I'm not suggesting that CCLA has the resources to do that, but certainly I think we're starting to come to a claim where there's this big mystery out there. So I will conclude simply on this. Ce n'est pas d'être anti-police que de demander un régime d'imputabilité qui soit à la mesure de nos attentes démocratiques. Au contraire, c'est honorer la fonction policière de leur demander that they be as good as they should be, as good as they ought to be. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, Nathalie. 10 minutes exactes. Alors, le défi est maintenant à M. Jacques Duchesneau.
Don't start now.
No.
Okay, me.
Your first word is when I hit the timer.
Okay, my first word? Okay, I won't talk. I need much more time. Natalie, as I was listening to you, I just want to say I'm not a bad guy, after all. That's not the purpose of the session here today. No, I know you're a nice person. You're a nice person. I think we can all spend our time asking questions about the effectiveness of police oversight and whether or not the complaint or investigative systems have been put in place. Are they working? But I think this is not the best use of our time, since I only have 10 minutes, because there will always be critics, you know, pointing fingers. That's the nature of the job of policing today. There will always be something to complain about. There will always be some successes and some failures. It's part of the job, and there will always be something we can improve. Rather, a better use of our time is to ask ourselves the most fundamental question: who polices the police? We were given 6 questions, and I think we should focus on who polices the police, the main one. If we know the answer to this question and are able to understand the foundations of effective police oversight, I think it would become much more easier, and you may be surprised at where it all begins. So let me explain. Police behavior is more and more subject to increased scrutiny. There's no doubt about it. Faced with a situation, police officers must reflect, make decisions, and make split-second choices. It is here that moral reflection begins, when someone asks himself the fundamental question of ethics. What should I do? Once again, in a split-second decision. Oftentimes, there is no easy answer and no clear right answer. Whose responsibility is it then to ensure that the right decisions are being made and the correct actions taken? Who should have the authority to make this type of assessment? I think the answer starts back 200 years ago. One of our neighbors here, Sir Robert Peel, who still lives here, well, he had a message in 1829, and if this message holds true today, the public are the police and the police are the public. We're not people who come from outer space. We are members of the community. I'm speaking as a former police officer. And simply put, who polices the police? I think we need to take a close look at that. There are a lot, I'd say plenty, of checks and balances already in place. And just to name a few, you'll see them in front here. There are internal standards. Altogether, there are 9 internal standards where people need to reflect on when they are sworn in as police officers. There are also laws and institutions that are overseeing how police work is being done. Same thing with the public and politics. There are many bodies, institutions looking closely at how policing is being dealt with. And obviously, there's the media and the new technologies. You must have seen those demonstrations earlier on this week and last week. And you see, you know, with the new iPhone, or, you know, policing is now done under the spotlight all the time. But altogether, you know, and I only put 31 of those. But every time a police officer needs to make a decision, he needs to think that there's going to be a lot of people looking over his shoulder. So the question is, do we need more or do we need better? That's the main question. I think in my experience, the key to effective police oversight is unlocking it from within. Without a doubt, the demand to identify and remove corrupt or brutal officers must come from the leadership of the police service, but first and foremost, from the very men and women who are out there on the streets every day, every night, policing the community and upholding the law and also upholding the order of the community. And we also know about first aid. If she goes bad, I'll be taking care of her. Don't worry. I'm always there for you. By the way, I'm also president of our fan club. So if you want a membership card, you just let me know. I've known Marlene for 20 and more. I was 12, so if 20. I'm 32. That's exactly it. So what are the key steps to unlocking? Yes. Will this count in my 10 minutes, or do I have some more free time?
You get 10 seconds.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot. So what are the keys to unlocking it from within? First, we need to understand and embrace the difficult task of policing today. It's not an easy job. Never was, and I think it is, like I said, scrutinized much more than it was when I first joined back a few years ago. And we also need to instill and promote and uphold core values and professional conduct standards. And on this, I agree with Natalie that, yes, we need to improve what is already in place, make sure that police officers know those core values and how, you know, they should be assessed from a professional standpoint. And we also need to acknowledge that ethics is much more than just a code or a procedure. Policing, it is a difficult task, like I said. Our reviews of policing are always initiated by particular incidents, which call us to question specific aspects of police actions, police operation, police behavior. In order to protect our lives and property, and to protect themselves as they do so, police officers carry guns. That's a reality. In other societies, they don't. We do over here. And this makes their profession unlike any other civilian one and delegates to them a unique and enormous power over other people. And unless they are properly, and I'm talking about the police officers, unless they are properly socialized and trained to understand the limits they must impose on themselves, and the compelling compelling reasons, okay, 3 minutes, behind those limits, well, I'm sure they will misuse this power. So I'll go faster. So police work obviously do not excuse misconduct by police officers. I've always been a very strong believer that police officers need to walk the straight line. But you have to understand that policing is one of the few professions where important decisions are made at the lowest level of the organization. You don't have many organizations that give such power to the people who are in the front line of the organization. There are controls and standards, and I've listed all of them over there on the screen before. Police officers need to know what is expected from them. It is very important. More than a code, yeah, it's a way of living. When it's time for you, you're a police officer, to make this important decision, you don't have time to think about all these rules, regulations, and procedures. You have to make this split-second decision, like I said. That's why there is an in-depth thinking to be made regularly on how these operations are being made. The four pillars of success, as far as I'm concerned, integrity comes in the front row. Transparency, I pressed the wrong button. But you must have seen that I was talking about integrity, impartiality, the proper use of force. And in conclusion, since my friend here is
1 minute,
it's important to know that the police are answerable to the law, and they don't act under the mantle of government, and we act on behalf of the community. Really, from my perspective, we are the least powerful players in the community and the most accountable in the community. So therefore, the most acceptable police in the world, that's really what I think we have here in Canada. So who guards the guards, who polices the police? You have to give me the 10 seconds that I needed. Well, the answer to that is, I think we all do have to look over the shoulder of police officers if there are any wrongdoings, and we need to speak out when we see something. And for this, you
excellent.
How did
You're
I do?
Right on time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jacques. And now we have Chief Dale McPhee, President of the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police and Chief of Police of Prince Albert. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you, Marlene. Just wait here till we get teed up. Just while we're waiting to get teed up, I don't know if you saw, though, Jacques and I were sharing glasses today. And, we tried to offer them to Natalie so she could see through the police lens as well. But she thought that Natalie was trying to give Jacques hers as well. So, police glasses, yeah. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, you're going to hear some of it of what Jacques said, but we'll get into some of it from the 30,000-foot level. And I certainly want to thank you for the invitation to speak at this important event on behalf of the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police. I have fond memories of McGill because back in 2004, I was on a Governor General's conference, and McGill was my home base. And I think it was one of my determining moments of probably those things that make you the type of leader that you are when you're with the quality of people that we were and some of the things that we were exposed to. So it's really fun and certainly enjoyable, and thank you for the invitation. So police are the first point of contact citizens have with the justice system, whether they are victims, suspects, witnesses, or simply members of the community. The title of this session speaks to the heart of policing in Canada, which is accountability. Let me start with the principles that govern policing in Canada, and so I answer the leading question, who polices the police? Our tradition has a direct link back to the father of modern policing, Sir Robert Peel, the basically the founder of the Metropolitan Police. His famous words about the role of the police in society are as relevant today as they were in his time. The ability of the police to perform their duties is dependent upon public approval for police actions. Police, at all times, should maintain a relationship with the public that gives reality to the historic tradition that the police are the public and the public are the police. The Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is the next touchstone. Its preamble states that Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. Finally, police officers each swear an oath of office that is established by the government in the jurisdiction of which that police officer is authorized to work. Police the police. Against the backdrop of principles, legal rights, and responsibility, let's look at who polices the police. Each police agency has its own internal discipline process to deal with officers' actions and decisions. Each has a process for addressing public complaints about individual officers and the police service in general. Individual officers' actions are assessed against professional standards, policies and procedures. A range of disciplinary measures is available to deal with each range of concerns. Internal review of a complaint may conclude that the police action goes beyond the threshold of what can be handled as a disciplinary measure. If the action is a potential criminal act, then it must be investigated as such. Citizens police the police. I won't discuss these examples in any depth. Each photograph here tells its own story about the public role in policing the police. During demonstrations in Toronto around the G20, meetings in the Stanley Cup riots in Vancouver, citizens took many photographs of police interactions with the public. In some cases, citizens responded negatively to their police use of force, but others commended police for their restraint in dealing with disorderly and destructive behavior. The marginalized gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, queer community has worked intensively with police to build a positive relationship that is largely focused on educating and sensitizing policing. Prostitution sweeps by police have been heavily criticized by sex trade workers as contributing to their personal safety risks. And we all seen the infamous mobile phone video taken by a fellow airline passenger at the events in Vancouver Airport in 2007. News media police the police. We cannot overlook the role of the news media in policing the police. Two stark examples come to mind. The Neil Stonechild case in Saskatoon brought to light allegations that police were transporting individuals out of the city on starlight tours in frigid winter. The case resulted in close scrutiny of police practices and eventual criminal convictions. The airing of the Stacey Bond cell block video in Ottawa had various impacts. Changes in police custody procedures resulted, as did criminal charges. The newly appointed Chief of Police of Ottawa has cited the need to rebuild community trust after this incident. Police are making fewer arrests. This is affecting local shelters in the community, which are now dealing with more cases of disorderly conduct. The media keep these cases alive, which may taint otherwise excellent police-community relations. In a positive sense, however, the community can focus on the bigger issues of systemic racism, tolerance levels of social disorder, and the threshold of police intervention. Oversight bodies police the police. Formal oversight is not new in Canada. Civilian oversight bodies have a growing role in policing the police. Let's consider Ontario's accountability regime, which we'll probably hear about in the next speaker when more in depth. The Ontario Civilian Police Commission is an independent oversight agency that reports to the minister. Its mandate is to ensure that the adequate and effective policing services are provided to the community in a fair and accountable manner under the Provincial Police Services Act. It deals with appeals against police disciplinary actions, the administration of municipal police services, and policing needs of a municipality. The Special Investigation Unit is a civilian body mandated to conduct criminal investigation into the serious injuries and deaths that result from police conduct. It is designed to increase public confidence in policing. A further step in the Ontario regime is the role of the provincial ombudsman, which made recommendations to reform the SIU in 2008 and criticized the Ontario government in 2011 for not doing so. Other provinces are looking at replicating this model, and other provinces also have things that work well. Complaints against the RCMP, if not resolved by the force, can be taken to the Commission for the complaints against the RCMP. This independent agency is mandated to ensure that public complaints about RCMP members are investigated fairly and impartially and reported to Parliament. The Commission can also initiate its own reviews. At the local level, police governance boards also police the police. The Toronto Police Services Board, for example, refused to promote certain officers who had been disciplined for removing their name tags during the G20 weekend. Courts police the police. Court decisions determine how police use current powers and establish limits to the use of powers, essentially policing the police. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled, for example, on police authorization, police use of investigative measures and techniques, police obligation to protect witnesses, and disclosure of investigative findings to defense. Similarly, provincial courts take decisions on the limits and appropriate application of police powers. In British Columbia, the court ruled on authority of police to enter a residence without a warrant. In Quebec, the court ruled that certain police actions at the Montebello Security and Prosperity Partnership Summit of 2007 were illegal. Governments police the police. At the highest level, governments police the police. The Criminal Code of Canada sets out the powers of police as determined by Parliament. Both federal and provincial governments can establish commissions of inquiry to examine incidents where police accountability emerges as a public policy issue. Governments can issue policy directives governing police. The Minister of Public Safety, for example, issued a policy directive to the RCMP in 2008, requiring the force to report on its disciplinary process. Modern legislation has built-in accountability regimes. Consider the reporting requirements within privacy and access to information legislation and the Witness Protection Act. Finally, selection of the most senior police leaders at local, provincial, and federal levels includes the commitment to accountability. Newly appointed RCMP Commissioner Bob Paulson has stated that leadership and accountability are his main responsibilities. CACP does not police the police. Let me return to the association that I'm representing here. The CACP does not police the police. It has no authority over police officers or organizations, and yet the CACP plays an active role in police accountability. Our 20 standing committees are committed to excellence in policing through accountability or expenditure of public funds, responsible use of technologies, building relationships with marginalized groups, or adopting promising and effective practices. Our research foundation promotes efficient and effective policing through research, education, and training. It has a particular focus on modern practices, crime trends, multiracial topics, and police responses to domestic violence. We manage the robust professional development program that addresses ethics, risk management, and leadership. Our objective is to maintain and strengthen public confidence in the police. CACP committees develop professional standards, making recommendations to police agencies and governments. Last year, our members endorsed the training standard for child exploitation investigations. National forums on specific issues stimulate informed dialogue, policing issues that are controversial. In 2009, the CACP hosted a multi-partner event, conducted energy weapons, seeking agreement on a threshold for guidance of their use. In conclusion, finally, the CACP Ethics Committee formulated an ethical framework which states, "A ethical foundation of justice, rule of law, moral core, human dignity, and democratic principles forms the context of ethical decision-making, which must guide our decision." This supports what the CACP is all about, leading progressive change in policing. And that ethics survey was conducted by Carleton University and gives us the roadmap and the guideline to move forward. Thank you. God bless and stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief McPhee-Dale. And now, Peter Tinsley, former director of the Ontario Special Unit Investigations Unit.
And the military police.
And former chair of the Military Police Complaints Commission. The floor is yours, Peter.
Thank you, Marlene. I'd observe at the outset that there's a downside to speaking last if you're given remarks preceding that are so rich with issues that you might want to disagree. Or, for that matter, in some parts, largely agree. But I'm coming at this from a slightly different perspective, perhaps, than the others. So as a practitioner of oversight, so maybe I can offer some somewhat differing but somewhat complimentary remarks. And I have my own glasses, and believe me, they're not rose-colored. Since the mid-'80s, independent police oversight in Canada has grown exponentially. With the creation of an oversight body in Prince Edward Island in 2009, every jurisdiction in Canada has an independent civilian police oversight body. And when I'm speaking of police oversight, I'm talking about a duly empowered, independent of any other stakeholder in the field of policing body, which is brought into being to assure the public that the rule of law is being applied. It is not in any way a replacement for any of the traditional mechanisms, whether those be police service boards or the courts, for that matter, who are the overseers of all Canadian society. It's a supplement thereto. And I would observe that with this complete establishment across Canada, not only does every province have one body for disciplinary or professional conduct complaints, three currently have specialized independent bodies for the investigation of potential criminality, and a fourth province is about to follow suit. Notwithstanding this complete field of jurisdictions, but I'd also digress momentarily to observe that there, despite the breadth of oversight agencies in the jurisdictions, there are some significant omissions of law enforcement personnel who are overseen. And these would include such as First Nations Police Services, but most significant, in my view, is the Canadian Border Services Agency. While not a traditional police force, it is nonetheless an active law enforcement agency operating across Canada and touching the lives of many Canadians daily using extraordinary powers. There is still evolution to occur. But at the same time, perhaps we should examine the apparent contradiction. All of this oversight, why? In a country that generally Canadians revere their National Police Service as an icon. Generally, nationally, there is unreserved mourning of a police officer injured or killed in the performance of their duty. We're a country that, unlike many countries in my experience in the world, streak-proof our children by in part telling them, if you get into trouble, seek out a police officer. All that, but at the same time, the Canadian community demanding clearer assurances of high standards of professional performance. The why, I find the answer for in part, again referring to Sir Robert Peel, who is a bit of a hero to me with his prescient nine principles of modern policing, pronounced in 1829, and particularly number two that Chief McPhee has already made reference to, that being the ability of the police to perform their duties is dependent upon the public approval of police actions. Canadian police services have historically enjoyed high levels of public approval and confidence. However, I would observe that confidence and approval may take a long time to establish, but particularly in growing so in this electronic age, also as referred to by two of the prior speakers, it can be destroyed very quickly, that approval, that confidence. And I believe in large part that is why there has been this exponential growth in oversight to provide our communities with the assurances that the rule of law is being applied and to in fact support the police at the end of the day by ensuring that level of approval through the actions of oversight agencies. Now, is the current system of oversight working? That's one of the questions that was posed to the speakers. I think in this regard, it's important to understand that there is not a system despite me talking about the breadth of oversight in the various jurisdictions, provincial and federal across the country, there is not a system in the sense of a common model. Each federal and provincial jurisdiction has responded to community demands in a way that was perceived to support their needs, and also in a way that could be, I would add, politically supported. In respect of the administrative or conduct, professional conduct category, there are at least four models that are based, and I'm saying four models based on broad characterizations of the statutory powers of those agencies, whether it is to initiate an investigation of its own volition, to in fact undertaking an investigation firsthand, or in some way directing the resolution of a complaint. Many of these agencies have been modified over time since their origins, many and often being strengthened. In fact, I think it's fair to say that the shift that has occurred in oversight generally has been to further empower oversight agencies from what originally were relatively benign audit functions to today a far more robust first instance jurisdiction in the handling of complaints. So my brief equivocal and some would say lawyerly answer to any question regarding the present functionality of the current system would be yes. The present oversight agencies are functioning and performing their service, but not as effectively as they might, and they must continue to evolve in order to meet the ever-increasing public expectations as expressed in part by Madame de Rosier, and the continuing challenges to their function, challenges which are common in many jurisdictions. I don't have time to go into the minutiae of challenges to jurisdictions that occur at the frontline level, but perhaps just looking at the strategic or structural level, I would touch on two. The first one being government support. It's important to remember that whilst oversight agencies are labeled independent, as I've been saying throughout, and they must be so, in fact and by perception in their operations. At the same time, there should be no mistake that they are creations of government and they are very much dependent on government support, and that support has not always been constant. I touch on an example already mentioned by the chief, and that is an example found in Ontario as revealed in the Provincial Ombudsman's December 2011 report entitled suggestively, Oversight Undermined, wherein it is recounted that the Attorney General's Ministry in fact blocked the release of the SIU's 2008-2009 annual report because it contained commentary on the roadblocks to the SIU's effectiveness, roadblocks attributed to the police. But even more telling, in that same Ombudsman's report was the release by the Ombudsman of a ministry briefing note to the Attorney General concerning the implementation of the Ombudsman's 2008 recommendations for the improved performance of the SIU. And that briefing note read in part, quote, as you know, the decision was made at the time of the report's release that largely due to vehement police opposition, we will not be considering the recommended legislative changes in the near future. The effect of the highly organized and powerful police lobby and resistance to effective and independent oversight cannot be underestimated, and civil society is hard-pressed to match it. Time flies. So I would simply, in respect to the second challenge that I wanted to refer to, was it should be appreciated that structurally based, the function of most, if not the majority of oversight operations across the country are largely dependent on police cooperation and police cooperation enforced by chiefs using internal police disciplinary systems. This places chiefs of police in an enviable position between the proverbial rock and a hard place. And remember my comments about police organizations and lobbies. Well, police associations put the chiefs to some extent in this position. And I suggest that there must be a search for change in terms of how these procedures are enforced, these procedures for the statutory empowerment for cooperation. And that will, if we look at various models, that will come largely out of removing the role of police chiefs in the enforcement of cooperation and indeed ultimately in the resolution or the disposition of cases, i.e. embracing the concept already in place in some provinces that serious matters of police conduct are referred under complaint out to an independent judicial officer. That, to me, will bring true credibility to the system. I'll part with just a couple of remarks regarding the G20 and joint force operations. There is legislation in at least six provinces that provides for the empowering of extra-provincial or out-of-province officers brought in on a joint force operation to stand in the shoes of a police officer and under the same regime of oversight as a police officer belonging to the host police service. So I suggest to you, until we see the final reviews of the G20, and that review undertaken starting in July of 2010 by the Independent Police Review Director in Ontario, the report, somewhat delayed perhaps, is due to come out sometime after Easter this year. And we will see what effect the interprovincial action or participation on these police joint operations comes. And I think we have to wait to see how that comes out. But because they stand in the same shoes, I suggest that present day, all we know is that for better or worse, the oversight regimes in an individual jurisdiction will be as effective or not as it is in dealing with in-jurisdiction officers. And finally, just because we are looking to the future in terms of challenges to oversight, and it was indicated in the program agenda that one of those challenges was the joint force operations, I would agree that may or may not prove to be the case. But I would leave you with the thought that perhaps the greatest future challenges for effective civilian oversight may not be the nature experienced in the past or currently, but be of a totally different nature, arriving out of the new police powers for non-judicially authorized seizure of electronic medium information as proposed in Bill C-30. While not of the nature of conduct traditionally the subject of complaints requiring independent police oversight, those powers, in my view, have the potential to affect citizens in ways equally intrusive and harmful as the effects of direct contact with the police. However, there are no provisions in the bill for oversight of any sort, and oversight agencies today are not currently oriented to undertake this potentially challenging role. Thank you.
It must be either that police training or coming into contact on a daily basis with police officers, but this has been fantastic. Each one of the panelists has kept to their 10 minutes on the dot. So I thank all of you. Before we go to the questions from the floor, and we will have close to 45 minutes for that, I have a question of each of you. Peter has just raised the issue of the changes to the privacy and new powers for our law enforcement may be the biggest challenge in terms of civilian oversight. Do you believe that even if the current organizations that have the authority to oversee the police across the provinces and nationally, regardless of whether it's a provincial or not, have sufficient powers to deal with complaints regarding the exercise of these new powers if this legislation comes into effect?
Who do you want to start? Me?
Anyone.
Okay.
I
have to disagree, and as Peter said with his comments earlier, things we're going to agree and disagree is Bill C-30 is what we're talking about here, and we're talking about lawful access to communications. And at the end of the day, this bill's been debated for 10 years. And the reality is if you go back 10 years and you back to the foundation of the bill, it dates back to the rotary phone. I think we've had a couple changes in technology since then, just a couple. Now, I don't want to demean the fact that there's a privacy piece to this, but I think the reality is it's a balance between privacy and safety. And really, we have automatic license plate readers right now that will give you more information that you can get out of an IP address. An IP address is basically a phone book in reference to what it is. Now, particular provisions of this bill, if I was to go through it, and I have gone through it in detail, to me, there's more accountability in the new bill than there is today. There's limited access to the amount of people that can are authorized to get the information. There's an audit process built into it. There's checks and balances. The privacy commissioner gets a regular report on the activities. And as I said, there's a training standard in relation to certain people that can exercise it. And right now, it's just a free-for-all. At the end of the day, I think they date back, and we're trying to use examples. The RCMP Child Exploitation Unit, for one particular provision, we're only got 75% of responses. And some of those responses for the request from the telcos took up to 15 days. So not to use scare tactics, because I think that's totally wrong, but use that in a practical sense. If your child was in danger of child exploitation and you could not get that information and you had to wait for 15 days, is that right? And this corrects that, but yet puts accountability into the piece. And I don't want to just refer it to that particular section, because it's way more than that. It's a change in technology to be able to allow police officers to do their job more effectively. There's no police officer or police chief in this country that does not think there should be accountability with that bill. That absolutely has to happen. But it's about balance. And when I get into balance, you know, the thing that bothers me most in this is that, as the president of the chiefs of police, we've got the group that says hard on crime, which is enforcement, arrest, and incarcerate, and there's the group that says soft on crime, intervention and prevention. And the reality is you need both. And it's balance. Or how about the conversation starts on smart on crime and looks at the ways we do the business versus being entrenched in a position that disallows or does not allow us to be effective. So I take exception, and I'm sorry, I'm a little bit passionate about that.
Thank you. Peter, I think you have something you want to say.
My remarks in opening this Pandora's box up were very brief, and yes, there are a couple of things that I would most respectfully take exception to with the chief's responding remarks. And the one, I'm glad he recovered and said smart on crime. The juxtaposition to hard or tough on crime is smart, not soft. Similarly, as we saw with the artificial move of the current government labeling this bill with its empathetic label of related to children, no one is suggesting that that is not a primary objective with our laws, is to protect our children from abuse. And in answer to the chief's question, I would not be suggesting necessarily that there be a delay of 15 days to get that information, and that we must construct so that operational exigencies can be met, but we must also construct so that there is oversight. With the current CPIC system, there can be, and driver license plate identification, the police already have significant powers for seeing into our lives, identifying people. And it's done in the same fashion as proposed under Bill C-30, silently. The people generally don't know it's happening. But I suggest that the chief will not dispute me in saying that in a number of cases in the last few years, the abuse of CPIC, the abuse of driver motor vehicle information systems crops up, and it appears in the context, it comes out of and is revealed in the context of other complaints. For instance, police officers who illegitimately using those systems to identify attractive young female drivers, and I've seen those cases. We don't have an external system to monitor those, and I suggest that there is not a sufficient one in to monitor the increased amounts of information and intrusive information that will be available under C-30, and not just to police officers, but to others.
Thank you. Natalie, you wish to comment?
Yeah, just briefly. I think the C-30 raises a whole bunch of issues, and I think the reason why privacy commissioners have not agreed with the bill is because of the disappearance of the warrants to obtain the IP identification that identifies a person. And you know, there's many reasons, and I take your point that there are some safeguards here, but people won't be able to make a complaint because they don't know. And that's a fundamental issue here. So the second point, I think, is it's not like the phone book, because the phone book, you can agree to be in the phone book or not agree to be in the phone book. This, you won't have a choice. And thirdly, I think the bill is not restricted to child molestation or something. It's for every crime. So if there is a balancing, if we are talking about, you know, there's no other way, and I think we still probably would want to know whether all alternatives had been explored. I think there is a way in which you could think about not having this bill applied to all and every crime. So my sense is, I think, the conversation that we're having here, we probably will have maybe in front of Parliament and in the public, but it's important to examine a range of options. As opposed to saying, you know, this has to apply all together. So, you know, certainly I think the disappearance of warrant, I think, is a danger. Warrants exist for good reasons. The reason why people like CCLA or like, you know, Human Rights Group, BCCLA and so on, think warrants are important is because they are the possibility of an outsider simply asking the question. You can get a telewarrant, it can be done quickly, but it's the outsider just ensuring that everything's been done. You know, it's just a small safeguard. Why not? You know, why abandon this? It would be my question.
I'm going to jump in here because in the interest of transparency and disclosure, when I was the justice critic for the official opposition, the Liberal Party of Canada, I actually tabled the legislation, Lawful Access, which the Liberal government under Mr. Paul Martin had tabled. And the reason why I did that was because the discussion was not happening, and the discussion needed to happen. There needed to be a modernization of techniques for law enforcement to be able to effectively, efficiently, and lawfully carry out investigations. I tabled it in exactly the same wording as it had been by the Liberal government. I was so far down the list, my legislation was never going to come before the House of Commons. But I wanted that discussion, which is now starting here, because of the question I asked, to happen. And hopefully the government of the day, today, will use its legislation to have that discussion. The best way to do it is for it to table the committee, the legislation before committee at first reading, because that then allows for fulsome debate, consultation, and major changes to the legislation if consensus is built on that. If it's tabled at second reading, modifications are very limited in scope. But I'm pleased that the discussion has begun here, and hopefully it will continue on Parliament Hill. We are now going to go to the public question and answer section. There are two microphones. I am going to be very strict. This is not a new speech. We've already had our plenary speakers, so I am going to ask that those of you who go before the microphone identify yourself, make a very brief question to allow for the greatest opportunity for all of the panelists who wish to speak to it to be able to do so, and to allow for the greatest number of participants to be able to ask their question. And if I find that you're actually pontificating and doing a soliloquy, I will cut you off. Je vous invite de vous présenter devant les deux micros. Je vous demande de ne pas faire une déclaration ou un autre discours. Cette section est questions et réponses, et dans l'intérêt de permettre le plus grand nombre de participants de pouvoir poser leurs questions, je vous demande d'être très succincte dans votre question, et ça permettra également à tous les panélistes qui veulent répondre à la question de pouvoir le faire. First microphone, I see Dr. Maione.
Oui, bonjour. Alors, oui. Antonia Maione, professeur agrégé au département de sciences politiques de l'Université McGill. I just want to start by thanking Chief McPhee for bringing up the question, this idea of street-proofing our children. And I want to say that as the mother of three young boys, every day, you know, you and your fellow police officers across Canada are on the street, on the sidewalks, protecting our children. I just want to thank you and Monsieur Duchesneau as well. Thank you very much. I have two questions. My first question is, if I would like us to drill down a little bit on the two concepts of oversight and accountability. Because what I heard a lot of in your presentations was a focus on oversight, the surveillance. But I'd like perhaps to have a little bit more information on the accountability measures, whether or not you feel that accountability, right? So whether when things do happen, whether or not we really do have the proper mechanisms and proper outcomes in terms of accountability. And my second question is, given your responses on C-30, I'd like to know if any of you have any comments on C-10, the bill that was passed earlier this week in Parliament, and whether or not, and I'd be especially interested to hear from the police officers, how you think this is going to affect your job protecting Canadians. Thank you.
Excellent questions. I leave the floor open. Who would like to speak to these questions? I see Peter.
I could just have a moment in respect to the first part of the question regarding oversight and accountability. I think we're talking about concepts that go hand in glove, the effective exercise of oversight leading to accountability. And why I say that, I did make some remarks about instances where an investigation was held up or upheld and resulting in either criminal charges or mechanisms to have disciplinary charges put in place and, in my view, then put before an independent judicial officer. That's accountability and public accountability in the instance where, as I say, an investigation upholds the notion that there has been a disciplinary offense or a criminal offense. The flip side of that, and I think equally important, sometimes more important, certainly more difficult to carry out, is the accountability in those circumstances where an investigation does not find a complaint or an allegation to be sustainable and leading to a charge, leading to a disciplinary offense, but must lead to an explanation by the oversight body in terms of why a charge was not found to be well-founded. In my experience, that was certainly the more difficult of the two results in any investigation. The laying of a charge, once you've got a foundation in peace, an investigation is relatively easy. Explaining to a community, to a family, to a victim, why you don't sustain, to me that's the high watermark of accountability and an absolute must-do.
Go ahead.
I do think that we were talking about the role that oversight brings in accountability. Accountability is about learning, is about creating a learning institution, and I think that's what we're talking about here, is using the successes but also the failure as creating the proper mechanisms within the organization to learn. And the diagnosis that I think we present here is that people know that policing is difficult. That's not the issue. I think people appreciate and are thankful for good policing. When it goes badly, when the expectations are not met, there's a duty to explain. There's a duty for people to understand why it did not occur the way it happened. And this duty takes so long, and it's so marred in bureaucracy, that the piece of simply understanding what went wrong or what could have been done differently is lost. And I was quite struck earlier on when, you know, two comments came. One that, you know, that there's a lot of important decision made at the lowest level in policing, and I agreed. I'm not sure that it's not the same in other institutions. you know, you said it's the most, but, you know, I'm thinking about daycare workers, I'm thinking about paramedic, I'm thinking about other, so, you know, I don't want to be in a comparing game. I said, I'm just saying there may be ways in which, and that's the idea of accountability by somebody from the outside. Sometimes can say, you know what they did to ensure that daycare workers do not abuse their power or are responsive both to the parents and the children and blah, blah, blah. Those are some of the tricks that they're doing. I mean, you know, I'm not saying you have anything to learn, but I'm just saying that's one possibility. The second part that I thought was interesting is most of our system demand that people finish their complaint mechanism internally before they move to the outsider, you know, épuiser le recours interne. There is a cost here, which is that if somebody has lost trust in the police, and, you know, they call us, okay, so I know how they feel.
Or they called the chief before, but yeah, they call you.
Yeah, eventually. Mm-hmm. So, and they, so the idea that, you know, there will be, you know, several months of interactions with the police that they blame for whatever happened is seen as adding insult to injury almost, you know. They're not going to be happy with, you know, there is a what I call the credibility gap, you know. There is a deficit here, and it's not being... So sometimes I wonder whether it would not be better to have the outsider earlier in the process to say, finalement, you know, yes, I heard you, but, you know, I think your expectations were unreasonable or something like that. So there may be ways in which the system functions that reemphasizes sometimes the feeling, the sentiment, that there's no accountability.
I left political correctness in the cloakroom, so I refrain from replying to some of the comments. But it seems that you are the best invention since sliced bread, in a sense that, you know, it's, you know, police chiefs before had accountability measures in place.
Yeah.
You know, it was not created by you, and they still do. Okay, and you know, some of the comments that I heard, I didn't follow Bill C-30. It's you know, I was sworn in as a police officer 44 years ago, and back then we only had to learn the criminal code, which was about that thick. Nowadays, and I showed you at least 31 organizations and institutions looking over police officers' shoulders. Do we need more? You know, hearing some of the comments, it seems that, you know, we live in a different world than the one I perceive. Yes, there are things that might be wrong, and there are wrongdoings by police officers. But just to remind you, in my tenure as chief, five-year tenure as chief, I terminated 25 police officers. So we did our job back then, and I guess police chiefs do their jobs also. So... you know, I think we put our pink glasses here, looking at. That's my point of view, and like I said, I know it's not political correctness at best.
I think Dale also wants to jump in here.
Well, I'll get to this one, and I'll go to your second question because you know, I think we need to start where the starting point is. Is we're actually pretty good at what we do in relation to accountability. Now, if we think that we can't change or we can't be better, we all know that that's one close to going out of business, as per se. I think you're always looking at a better way. My job is accountability as a police chief. That's what I'm signed up. That's what my contract is. I'm the bridge of the public. I'm the guy that has to sit, and I'm the guy that has to stand in front of the media when things don't go wrong. And I take that serious, just as anybody in, as a prof in this institution would take that serious defending your program. That said, is, you know, I've sat on a health board, you know, I've been on more boards and committees than I can imagine. When I say we're doing a pretty good job, we truly are. But I think accountability is something that we as a CACP did an ethics survey, and I don't know of any other profession that actually got a university to come in and look at our inner soul and tell us how can we improve, and we've done that. So I think we always want to find that way, and I don't take exception to say that we can be better, because that's just relevant to where we're trying to go. But we do a pretty good job, and I just want people not to leave this room and thinking that their police in this country or the ultimate bad guy, or bad girl, or whatever you want to refer to it, because we truly aren't. We've got a real profession that's made strides. I've traveled across this country and internationally, and I think we're one, and Peter's work certainly has been a large part in that in certain areas. So I want to start with there. Now I want to move to C10 and really get this going. Okay, because C10, as a CACP, we support C10. And I tell you why we support C10. And I use the analogy is we're not going to arrest our way out of our troubles, but we're never going to stop arresting. I use those in the same breath. Because the reality is there's people in this country that need to go to jail. And if it's the serious crime, which C10 is, that's probably some of the people that should be in our institutions. Now, it doesn't mean we forget about them. We've got great programs in the institutions, Courage to Change and other things for rehabilitating, reintegration into society. But you can't do that in isolation. Going back to hard on crime, arrest and incarcerate, soft on crime, prevention and intervention. When I look at my police statistics, and I take, I'm a smaller police, well, not a mid-sized police service, but I take per call capita, or my calls per capita are pretty high. 27% of my calls that we respond to are criminal in nature. 5% lead to criminal charge. That tells me that 73% of what I do is other than criminal behavior. And what could we define that as? And let's define it as antisocial behavior, addictions, mental health, housing. The list goes on. All of those things that are really driving the services in our hospitals, they're driving our social services, they're driving our tax dollars, and yet we talk one or the other, and really, why are we not doing both? We can reasonably predict and project through education, social services, health, and police where somebody is headed, and yet before we use our resources to go in there and ask what we can do to help, we wait till they're in the system, and then we tell them how they should fix themselves or how we could fix them. To me, we can improve on that. If we improve on that area, we won't fill the jails like everybody thinks we will, because there's a large group of that particular portion of our population, in my opinion, that I think are poor souls. And if we put a more focus on early intervention, what we've learned through academia and through the health and through social services, but police don't have the expertise in them, yet we're the first response. There's a real savings, if you want to talk institutions, that I think we have to get away from focusing on some of the serious, because there's people that need accountability. We'll always have it. In utopia, my imperfect policing in this country would be, I didn't need my job. We know that's not going to happen. So that would be my comments on that.
Okay. We have three people at the microphone. We have 15 minutes left. And as you see, our panelists really are enjoying answering questions and commenting each other. So what I'm going to suggest is we're going to do all three questioners, and then we'll go to the panel, and the panel will close up the session. You're first.
Bonjour. Mon nom est Louis. Je suis étudiant à la faculté de droit de McGill. So my question is pretty short. We spoke about mechanism to ensure accountability. I want to know, how do we make sure that these mechanisms can work properly in a context where identification of police officers is such a problem in protest? Donc, par exemple, par le refus de s'identifier qui est récurrent dans chaque manifestation, dans le fait que les marques d'identification sur les unités d'intervention du service de police de Montréal sont souvent cachées ou invisibles, et puis qu'il y a absence de forme d'identification visible dans plusieurs cas.
Bonne question. You're next.
I guess we're on the same page here. So my question was also related to the student protests that I've seen lately. I'm from the U.S., and I've been interested by the amount of student protests in the streets in the past year, and also interested in the police response and how the police have handled it. So I was curious to know how you would evaluate the police response, and if there's oversight of police response to big protests like the ones we've seen. Thank you.
And yeah, I'll go quickly, especially because some of it was already covered. I'm here as I'm a law student at McGill, and I'm here as someone who did spend the afternoon of June 26th of 2010 being brutalized or being terrorized and watching my friends be brutalized by police officers. And I wanted to come to learn about the oversight and accountability mechanisms that existed, and I'm a little disturbed to see it be characterized as something about just weeding out corrupt officers, that just is seeing that officers who didn't have name tags on are not being promoted is not enough and is not satisfactory to those of us who were there and who experienced this. I'm wondering if all, Mr. Deschenaux, if all the mechanisms for oversight and accountability that you mentioned, if any of those do you think can offer solutions and offer things, I guess, a strategy going forward? Because from what I could see, it was the overall police strategy that was the problem, not just individual officers.
Okay, so I'll cover both answers. Identification, I totally agree with you. I mean, police officers should be clearly identified. I haven't followed that very closely, and I was, as I was mentioning in an interview I was giving this week, funny that I had to reflect on it this week because I'm also a teacher at university, so I have my students demonstrating in Montreal, and I have my former colleagues dealing with my students. So it's a very funny position. But demonstration, you know, it can flip very quickly. I was the chief in Montreal when we faced the last referendum. And at one moment, when the yes group learned that they were losing, they all walked towards the no group. And it could have flipped either way. And when you're seated in the chief's chair that night, you know that you cannot fail because consequences are going to be bad. I was reading the London Times yesterday. The young 16-year-old boy who punched a 68-year-old during the August riots in London last year. But it happened like this, So when you are trying to control a crowd, it's always difficult. And, being the Monday morning quarterback, we can say, this should have been done and this should have been done. Easy to say, but once you're faced with such a reality, you need to act very quickly, and mistakes happen. You probably want to refer to the incidents where the student got injured by a stun bomb. Once again, it's a judgment call that is being made. They work with the tools that they have. They might have made a mistake throwing that at a lower level. That's one aspect that needs to be looked at. The one thing that I don't accept at all is that when this young injured kid went to a police officer, his answer was, "I'm going to call an ambulance." Well, I'm very sorry. That's not the way we were trained. When someone is injured, you need to take care of the injured people. Just calling an ambulance does not fulfill your duties. So this really made me upset. The stun bomb, once again, a judgment call, couldn't make a mistake, and we have to live with mistakes that people make.
If I can just add on this, because I was part of civilian oversight of law enforcement, first with the Quebec Police Commission, which had jurisdiction over all police forces in Quebec, and then as Deputy Commissioner for Police Ethics for the province of Quebec. And at the time that I was in both positions, Jacques Deschenaux was first the Assistant Director of Police of Montreal and then the Director. Part of the accountability is when you do have these independent agencies, and the agencies actually have decent powers and do their job properly, when they do identify, sometimes the police officer may be found guilty or may be found not guilty, but they look at the actual procedures, the trainings, etc., that led to the particular incident, there are recommendations that are made that perhaps the training should be modified in order to better prepare the police officer or to make them better aware of different circumstances that could arise. The actual tools that are used, whether it's the taser gun, whether it's the stun bombs, etc., that would be part of the oversight that is done. So there is accountability, and we do see police forces changing their practices
and changing the training of the officers in response to the kind of accountability, if it's good accountability and good oversight that is done, whether it's here in Quebec or in other provinces. Where there's a problem is when the oversight body doesn't have sufficient authority, in my view, and has to rely on the good wishes of the police force or the police chief to give up the documents, to ensure that the meetings take place, the interviews take place, etc. And we have models that they don't have to rely on that. They have the authority, they can order the officers, they can order the documents. Peter, you wanted to comment?
Two of the questions I'd like to address, the one in respect of identification, which is absolutely basic. The identification of officers, it went through a period where it became very unpopular, and understandably so, in the police community because of the officer safety and that form of identification that had been historically used, the name of the police officer. Some of you may be familiar with the events that took place in Imperwash, Ontario, a First Nations reserve, or at least the park adjacent there too, in 1997. One of the principal recommendations that I made in an SIU report to the Commissioner of the OPP and then Solicitor General of Ontario was officer identification, because it was revealed that not only could the public not in any way identify officers in a common uniform of riot gear, but it was understood that even without names they could be numerically identified. It's one of the disturbing things when you refer to the G20, and I think we've all got to be careful. We were talking about new forms of oversight, and the police constantly, or today, with the electronic media and cameras on cell phones, et cetera, being under observation all the time. Well, there's that old maxim with which I agree that a picture can be worth 10,000 words, but sometimes 10,000 words don't tell the whole story. You've got to have more than the picture. One picture I found disturbing in the front page of the Toronto Star a couple of days ago, with showing a police officer in what appeared to be a very violent situation, kicking a man who was down in the back, was it was notable that that police officer, amongst three in the photograph, did not have his Toronto identification on his body armor, the numbers that the officer standing next to him did. Hopefully, this sort of issue will be something that, as I say, when we look for the more than the 10,000 words, I made reference to the review report that's been undertaken over 2 years by the Independent Police Review Director. I'm looking forward to it sometime after Easter with great interest, and I've been involved with investigations long enough to respectfully suggest to you that we not jump ahead of that, that we should wait and see what a complete investigation reveals in terms of those very tumultuous circumstances that obviously you were involved in.
Yes, I think the identification of police officers is part of the issue, but it's not the whole issue. Certainly, I think people get angry if they can't, if there is a failure of identification, and I think it's great that this continues to be commitment from the top to say, you know, identification is part of the public duty. Sometimes I think even if there is identification, people, you know, like it's difficult to know who it is because you're not trained to take badge number because you don't expect. It's something unexpected. And so on. So, you know, one of the issue that happens in the accountability is that if you're a witness, you cannot make a complaint. Like we were witnesses on some of these things. We made complaints. These complaints are rejected because we're not the main complainant. We didn't, you know, some of our monitors got arrested or injured, but not others. So, and to me, I think this is one way where you might be able to make the system a little bit more receptive to say, well, even if it's not the person itself that received the, because, you know, she may not have thought about taking down the badge number, witnesses that have seen this, that doesn't mean that the process is, you know, to root out or to be unfair to the police officers, but somebody needs to say what happened. And, you know, there's something that needs to be looked at and responded. So to me, that's, I think the identification is one part, but I think more generally we have to see that it may not suffice. I think just to finish on the overall strategy, certainly I think we're looking forward to the OIPRD report to see how far it is. We also have laid complaints at the RCMP level because they were the primary organizers. And maybe I will stop here on saying two things. It seems to me the communication strategy of the police also has to be looked at. How much, you know, the freedom to peacefully assemble is not one that every Canadian loves, you know. We love peace, order, and good government, you know. People are very afraid of disorder. And the freedom of peaceful assembly, you know, is one that frightens people. Now, what is the right communication strategy to make the general public understand, and I have seen it well done at times, you know, where the Toronto police and some of the protests were there explaining to people that disagreed with the protest, well, that's their right because in a democracy, people have the right to express themselves by walking down the streets. When they do that job of reconciling that a democratic right exists for everyone, we salute them. And I think we have at times, you know, we did that in many things. When the message is, the protesters is inherently dangerous here. That, I think, is the wrong communication strategy, and I think that leads to trouble both within the message inside the force that may lead to people to maybe make the wrong call that they would not otherwise do. So I think the strategy, we hope that not only will the overall strategy, training, the difficulty and whatever happen, but also the communication strategy. What was the objective and how people were told to perform. We're hoping that this will be looked at as well.
Thank you. Dale.
I'll just try to summarize rather than go through a lot of this stuff again. I'd like Marlene's comment on the recommendations because somebody on the floor mentioned the system versus the event. And I think there's two fundamental differences. The event generally could have discipline, could have things that come with relation to accountability. The system is how can we be better so it doesn't happen again? And I think we have some accountability on both of those expectations. And I think in Canada, we have high expectations of our police, and I really believe we should, because I think, you know, that's what we're trying to do is become a profession. But I think we can't lose sight of the fact that we have thousands of officers across this country, and if you just pictured yourself having thousands of employees, you're going to have some problems. It doesn't mean it's acceptable, but at the end of the day, you have to have a mechanism, and I think you were the one that was saying that, and that's something that we take very, very serious. What I will tell you that one of the priorities in my mandate as the president of the CACP is that we really look internally on how we handle protests and riots. It's a national thing. It's an international thing. It seems to be a bit of an emerging trend. And I think there's some real best practices that we can pull out in relation to how we respond and how we deal with these things more effectively. I think particular things, it goes back to that balance piece, the balance between safety and the right to protest. There's thousands of protests that go on every day in this country, and the majority of them are largely peacefully. The police are involved in a proactive manner. And then we have so-called some of these riots that really go offside or off the rails because there's some antagonists that's their professional job. And we shouldn't put these people in the same boat. And that is, again, going back to the study piece, and we have to get this right. And is there a more effective way to do it? When you look at Occupy and the response in the police and most of the Occupy situations that happen across our country, it was more of proactive, let's not overreact, you know, the right to demonstrate. But then when it became a public or an issue, it really came back to the civic government of the day to decide what action through they were going to do, whether it was through bylaw or through legislation, and that led to a police response. And it's important that we get this right, but it's important to realize, yeah, there has been some mistakes made, but how do we look at the system to make it better, that so when you're caught in the middle of that innocently, and I'm from Saskatchewan, so I don't know all the details in relation to that, but let's make those assumptions that as a profession, how can we make ourselves better? And I think we're truly, truly, as police leaders in this country, to be the respected voice in policing, that's our job.
Jacques, as-tu quelques mots de fin?
No.
Okay. Well, we are now at 3:15, the end of this plenary session. I'd like to thank our panelists, Nathalie Desrosiers, Jacques Duchesneau, Dale McPhee, and Peter Tinsley, for great presentations. Turn the mic over to Dr. Straw.
Et merci beaucoup à Marlene qui a non seulement présidé la session, mais en fait qui l'a organisé, qui a invité tous les intervenants. We now have a break of 15 minutes. Please be back at 3:30 for the very interesting next panel.